For headlines this hour, Iraq's national security advisor says that his country does not need any foreign combat troops on its soil as Washington and Baghdad engage in strategic dialogue. Muslim activists have been found on a list of British citizens hacked by foreign regimes as a scandal surrounding an Israeli spyware deepens. We'll have a report from London. And thousands of Australians rally in two major cities to voice their anger at coronavirus lockdowns. Police clash with protesters in Sydney. Welcome to the studios near the capital, Tehran. This is Mies. Thanks for joining us. The top Iraqi official has reiterated that his country does not need U.S. combat troops on its soil anymore. The National Security Advisor, Qasem al-Araji, said that Baghdad has communicated its stance over the issue to Washington. The comment came ahead of a meeting between senior Iraqi and American officials in Washington on Monday, where they are expected to issue a statement on the possible exit of U.S. combat troops from Iraq by the end of the year. Iraq's Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi and Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein have also underlined that Washington needs to pull out its forces from the Arab country. In January 2020, Iraq's parliament issued a resolution demanding the expulsion of American forces. That followed the U.S. assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and the Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. Brian Berletich is an independent geopolitical analyst who joins us from Bangkok. So I don't know about you, but this is a very confusing story. I'm trying to understand the stance here of the U.S. and its presence on Iraqi soil. Are we looking at the combat mission ending and for those forces to leave the country? Or are we looking for the combat mission ending and for those forces to actually then take on an advisory role? Or are we looking at the U.S. forces leaving Iraq completely?
I think that the Iraqi government and the people of Iraq would like the United States to leave altogether. The U.S. has claimed that they're there at the invitation of the Iraqi government, but in reality, they invaded in 2003 illegally, and they've just never left. And the combat mission had ended, and they maintained a military presence there, and then they surged back in 2014. And so it could end up doing exactly that all over again, where they claim they're leaving, they're withdrawing, but they maintain a presence of some kind there. And this threat of U.S. military aggression within Iraq's own borders is constantly looming over the head of the people in that region.
So let's just take a step back here, and perhaps, maybe it's just the way that I'm looking at this, but trying to understand how it is that a country who wants foreign forces to leave has to go get permission from the foreign forces boss, namely Joe Biden. I mean, what does that say about sovereignty then? I mean, or does the U.S. have some kind of leverage over Iraq to stay there? Because as you just mentioned, and as it's evident from the Iraqi parliamentarians to Iraqi people, they want the U.S. forces out. Why do they need permission?
This is just another illustration of how the U.S. actually operates upon the global stage versus how they claim they operate. So we saw a recent act of U.S. military aggression on the Iraqi-Syrian border where they struck these militias that are actually backed by the Iraqi government to fight ISIS. And the U.S. claims that they were doing that in an act of self-defense. But again, their presence is unwanted in Iraq, and it is completely illegal in neighboring Syria. And so they just have this myriad of excuses, legal, political, based on perceived national security threats, to keep their forces there against everybody's will and against the best interests of peace and stability in the region. And we can see on a daily basis how the U.S. is undermining, not upholding peace and stability in the Middle East.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that attack. That's the second one that took place under Joe Biden. And given that has happened, do you think that the Iraqi government will set a precondition for the U.S. that it can't just act on its own? I'm not too sure if it's being, if it's being communicated by the U.S. whether it's going to follow through with a military action on its border. But do you think that will be a precondition for Iraq, for the U.S. not to do this?
I think that the greatest irony of that act of aggression was that the U.S. was claiming that it was doing it in self-defense, and that they're in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqi government. But immediately following that attack, the Iraqi government condemned it as a violation of Iraqi sovereignty. So the U.S. makes it clear, and it should be obvious to everyone at this point, that they don't care about sovereignty anywhere, especially in Iraq. This is a nation that has suffered an illegal invasion, a devastating war, and an enduring occupation by U.S. forces. And the U.S. can try to dress it up any way that they want, but they are the chief driving factor of chaos in the region. They are not part of the solution, and things will not improve until their presence there wanes and eventually fades for good.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. Brian Brilatich, independent geopolitical analyst from Bangkok. Many thanks. Well, the U.S. president has pledged to keep supporting Afghan forces as the Taliban are pressing on with their territorial gains in the war-torn country. Joe Biden made the pledge in a phone call with his Afghan counterpart, Ashraf Ghani. According to the White House, the two leaders also agreed that the Taliban's current offensive contradicts the group's claims of supporting a negotiated settlement of the conflict. Under peace deals struck in February 2020, the U.S. agreed to withdraw its remaining forces in return for security guarantees from the Taliban. The U.S. invaded Afghanistan in 2001 under the pretext of fighting terrorism. 20 years later, the country remained unstable and is marred by deadly violence. Over the past several weeks, Taliban militants have also seized a number of large territories and important border crossings. Beijing has slapped sanctions on several U.S. individuals in response to Washington's bans on Chinese officials in Hong Kong. Among those targeted is former U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross. China's retaliatory sanctions follow a recent U.S. warning to companies about the risks of doing business in Hong Kong. Beijing has slammed the U.S. sanctions against Chinese officials in Hong Kong as illegal and a serious violation of international law. Reacting to the sanctions, the White House said that Washington is undeterred by China's actions.
These actions are the latest examples of how Beijing punishes private citizens, companies, and civil society organizations as a way to send political signals and further illustrate the PRC's deteriorating investment climate and rising political risk. These
actions. Jen Psaki described Beijing's sanctions as outrageous, claiming that the U.S. officials targeted only promoted democracy and human rights around the world. She described China's move as a sign of its further isolation from the world. The hacking scandal surrounding Israeli spyware Pegasus is deepening. UK Muslim activists from prominent organizations have been on a list of some 400 British citizens hacked by foreign regimes. Rob Carter has spoken with one of those victims. He believes Israel's regional ally, the UAE, has been spying on him over criticism of the human rights abuses.
More victims of a malicious Pegasus software hacking scandal have been revealed, as phone numbers of several prominent British Muslim activists have appeared in a leaked list of successful hacks by the Israeli-made spyware. The list includes Raghad al-Tikriti of the Muslim Association of Britain, Mohammed Kosbar of Finsbury Park Mosque, Baroness Paula Odin, and Anas al-Tikriti of the Cordoba Foundation. Mr. al-Tikriti suspects he was hacked by agents from the Emirates over his past criticism of the regime.
I've had a long-standing struggle with the UAE, and simply because over 10 years ago, I highlighted the fact that the UAE had persecuted and followed on by a prosecution of dozens of reformists, of people who called for democracy, who called for accountability, who called for transparency in their own country. It's a scandal. It's a complete scandal, just like all the scandals that engulf us, unfortunately, on every single level. Infringing on someone's entire life. I mean, this Pegasus software, apparently, I'm no technician, but I understand that I'm being told by experts that it basically takes control of your mobile phone, which essentially is, and this is, you know, something that humanity needs to contend with, is our entire lives.
At least 400 British citizens have been targeted by foreign regimes using Pegasus, yet number 10 has remained stunningly silent on the matter.
How on earth could Great Britain, no less, be blasé regarding 400 of its citizens being attacked in such a callous, obscene, despicable manner by a regime that is non-democratic, absolutely, it's anti-democratic, authoritarian, rogue, corrupt regime such as the United Arab Emirates.
The UAE have failed to respond to the accusations, but they are ultimately just one of up to 40 regimes currently using the Pegasus service. The real question for British victims is, did local intelligence services know about the hacking? And if not, how could this failure have possibly been allowed to occur? Robert Carter, London.
Anti-lockdown protesters have clashed with police in the Australian city of Sydney as anger boils over month-long restrictions driven by Delta variant of COVID-19. Several protesters were arrested in the capital city of New South Wales. Similar rallies were also held in Melbourne. The protests held a day after authorities suggested that COVID restrictions could remain in place until October. New South Wales has been under strict stay-at-home orders since late June. However, the state has broken records for daily caseloads in recent days. On Saturday, it reported the biggest daily rise in infections, registering 163 cases. Authorities have already declared a national emergency. The recent outbreak of the virus, largely blamed on the Delta variant, has also prompted restrictions on other Australian states. Around half of Australia's 25 million populations are now under lockdown. The coronavirus pandemic continues to take its toll in Southeast Asia as the number of infections keeps rising in the region. Malaysia reported some 16,000 new cases on Saturday, the highest daily infections since the beginning of the pandemic. That brings the total caseload there to nearly 1 million. Meanwhile, Vietnam imposed a lockdown in the capital Hanoi on Saturday. That is the latest attempt to curb a serious COVID-19 outbreak that has already forced about a third of Vietnam's 100 million people to stay home. Authorities also reported more than 7,000 new cases on Friday, the third record number of daily infections in a week. Vietnam has seen a surge in the disease since late April. The Olympics opening ceremony officially kicked off the Tokyo 2020 Games, which were delayed for a year due to the pandemic. Athletes paraded in a near-empty stadium as spectators were banned from all Olympic Tokyo venues. That comes against the backdrop of growing popular opposition in Japan against the Games.
The long-awaited Olympic Games officially kicked off in Tokyo on Friday after a one-year postponement due to the coronavirus pandemic. The opening ceremony took place with no spectators in attendance and a reduced number of athletes joining the parade. Only fewer than 1,000 VIPs and officials were present at the Tokyo's National Stadium. The International Olympic Committee has banned foreign and domestic spectators for the first time in the history of the Olympic Games. Meanwhile, athletes, support staff, and media are subject to strict COVID-19 protocols. Most world leaders decided not to participate in the event. Also, top sponsors have stayed away, highlighting strong opposition to holding the event in COVID-fatigued Japan. Tokyo is battling a surge in coronavirus infections and is under emergency measures. Daily cases in Tokyo are currently at their highest in 6 months. The Japanese capital logged nearly 2,000 new daily infections before the official opening ceremony. Japanese officials have vowed to hold safe and secure games despite the lingering pandemic. However, a largely unvaccinated Japanese public is worried that the global gathering of 11,000 athletes could trigger a super spreader event. Earlier this week, the chief of the Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee said they are not ruling out canceling the games as more athletes pulled out after testing positive for COVID-19. So far, over 100 people linked to the games have tested positive for the virus. A survey by the Asahi Shimbun newspaper says around 70% of Japanese people believe that Olympic organizers are not able to contain coronavirus infections. For weeks, there have been calls for the already postponed games to be cancelled amid the rise of COVID-19 cases in Tokyo and elsewhere across the world. Hundreds of people gathered outside Tokyo's National Stadium ahead of the Olympic opening ceremony, while others demonstrated near the Tokyo government building to demand the cancellation of the event. However, The International Olympic Committee has rejected the idea of calling off the event. The committee could lose billions of dollars in broadcast rights if the games were cancelled. That could be a blatant example of choosing money over people's lives.
The Iranian president says that his administration is escalating efforts to solve water shortage problems in the southwestern province of Khuzestan. Hassan Rouhani said some issues have been tackled in the past few days with the measures undertaken by the government. He also referred to recent remarks by the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution that had urged officials to seriously address the issue. Rouhani expressed hope that the remaining issues will be soon tackled following an official visit to the province by Vice President Eshaq Jahangiri and a group of cabinet ministers. Meanwhile, the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, Major General Hussein Salami, is also on a visit to the province to monitor the implementation of IRGC's water supply plans there. The province is facing a severe water shortage, blamed largely on an unprecedented drought in decades. Iran has stressed the need for establishing sustainable peace in southern Caucasus as sporadic border clashes continue between Azerbaijan and Armenia. Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh urged both Baku and Yerevan to show restraint and to settle their border issues through peaceful means. He also said that Iran is ready to help the two neighbors reach a sustainable peace. Comments came after new clashes erupted between Azeri and Armenian troops along their shared borders on Friday. An Azeri soldier was killed and three Armenian troops were wounded. This is the latest brawl between the countries since a war over the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region last year, which claimed about 6,500 lives. The six-week war ended in November with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Venezuela says that a U.S. military plane violated its airspace, pledging to respond forcefully to any maneuver that it deems as an act of aggression. Venezuela's defense ministry said that a U.S. Type C-17 heavy military transport aircraft crossed into the country's airspace along the border with Colombia. It described the violation as a flagrant provocation that took place during a joint military exercise between the U.S. and Colombia. Venezuela does not have diplomatic relations with the U.S. and Colombia, a country with which it shares a porous border of more than 2,200 kilometers. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight. Republicans on Friday, 28th of May, blocked the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol riot, using their filibuster power in the Senate for the first time this year to doom a full accounting of the deadliest attack on Congress in centuries. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Nicholas Vandos and Emily Cochrane. The piece is titled, Senate Republicans Filibuster 6th of January Inquiry Bill Blocking an Investigation. Republicans on Friday, 28th of May, blocked the creation of an independent commission to investigate the 6th of January Capitol riot, using their filibuster power in the Senate for the first time this year to doom a full accounting of the deadliest attack on Congress in centuries. The vote was a stark display of political self-interest by Republicans determined to shield themselves from an inquiry that could have publicly tarnished their party. They feared an investigation that would remind voters of the consequences of former President Donald Trump's election lies and how Republican lawmakers indulged them, spurring their supporters to violence. Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader, has made a clear choice that his and his party's fortunes depend on putting the events of 6th of January behind them. It all but guaranteed that there would be no comprehensive nonpartisan inquiry into the attack's root causes, the former President Donald Trump's conduct, as his supporters threatened lawmakers and the vice president, or any connections between his allies in Congress and the rioters. While members of both political parties agreed in its immediate aftermath that an investigation was indeed needed, most Republicans have since toiled to put the episode behind them, and some have actively sought to deny or to play down the reality of what happened on 6th of January. On Friday, 28th of May, only six Republicans joined Democrats to support advancing the measure to create an independent commission. The final vote, 54 to 35, fell short of the 60 votes needed to move past a Republican filibuster. The vote was a stinging defeat for proponents of the commission. They had argued that the only way to assemble a truly complete account of the rioting for a polarized nation was through an inquiry modeled after the one into the 11th of September 2001 attacks, in which outside experts with subpoena power undertook a thorough study. Some Republicans expressed disgust with their own party for blocking it, saying that they had put politics over the finding of what promised to be a grim set of facts. "I don't want to know, but I need to know," said Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, one of six Republicans who voted to form the commission. To be making a decision for short-term political gain at the expense of understanding and acknowledging what was in front of us on 6th of January, I think we need to look at that critically. While the Justice Department has opened hundreds of criminal cases against rioters, and congressional committees are likely to expand nascent inquiries, they will almost certainly confront limits that a commission staffed with national security experts, jointly appointed by Republicans and Democrats, would not. Among them are partisanship, defiant witnesses, and turf wars that are likely to leave unanswered key questions about how the party rallied around Donald Trump's stolen election lies and his demands that Republicans invalidate Joseph Biden Jr.'s victory. "Do my Republican colleagues remember that day?" Senator Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York and a majority leader in the Senate, asked moments after the vote. "Do my Republican colleagues remember the savage mob calling for the execution of former Vice President Mike Pence, the makeshift gallows outside the Capitol? Shame on the Republican Party for trying to sweep the horrors of that day under the rug because they're afraid of Donald Trump," he added. Top Republicans had entertained supporting the measure as recently as last week, but they ultimately reversed course, and the House approved it with only 35 Republican votes. Leaders concluded that open-ended scrutiny of the attack would hand Democrats powerful political ammunition before the 2022 midterm elections, and enrage a former president they are intent on appeasing. I do not believe the additional extraneous commission that Democratic leaders want would uncover crucial new facts or promote healing, Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the Republican leader in the Senate, said on the eve of the vote. Mitch McConnell added, "Frankly, I do not believe it is even designed to do that." Though Mitch McConnell said he would continue to support criminal cases against the rioters and stand by his unflinching criticisms of Donald Trump, the commission's defeat is likely to only embolden the former President Donald Trump at a time when he has once again ramped up circulation of his baseless and debunked claims. Republicans had already saved Donald Trump from conviction in two impeachment trials. In a matter of months, Trump's lies have warped the views of many of his party's supporters who view President Joe Biden as illegitimate. They have also inspired a rash of new voting restrictions in Republican-led states and a quixotic recount in Arizona denounced by both political parties. And they have fueled efforts by Republican members of Congress to diminish and reframe the Capitol riot as a benign event akin to a normal tourist visit. People are just now beginning to understand, Donald Trump wrote in a statement on Thursday, 27th of May. Democrats denounced the vote and warned Republicans that preventing an independent inquiry would not shield them from confronting the implications of Donald Trump's attacks on the democratic process. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader in the Senate, and Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi are now planning their own committee investigations into the rioting and attack on 6th of January, how it was coordinated and why the government failed to prevent an assault that left several people dead, the Capitol building ransacked, and those inside the Capitol building at risk. Nancy Pelosi could also set up a select committee focused solely on the attack, handing Democrats unilateral subpoena power and a much longer timeline to investigate whatever they want. Chuck Schumer seemingly endorsed the idea on Friday afternoon, saying it was better to investigate with a select committee than not investigate at all. Progressives seized on the Republicans' opposition to the commission as new justification to press their case for invoking the so-called nuclear option to rewrite the filibuster rule and allow bills to pass on simple majority votes. Activists have pressed Democratic leaders to do so and then skirt Republican opposition to enact pressing liberal priorities like a sweeping voting rights measure, gun control legislation, legislation of undocumented immigrants, and much more. If the Republicans can't agree to the independent commission investigating the first armed insurrection at the Capitol in our nation's history, then something has gone badly wrong, said Senator Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat from Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren added, and that something is the filibuster. But changing the rules would require the agreement of all 50 Democrats, and at least two oppose the move. One of them, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, said that his position was unchanged. "I'm not willing to destroy our government, no," Joe Manchin said. Still, after an 11th-hour scramble with Senator Susan Collins, Republican of Maine, to draft a compromise to address some of her party's stated concerns about the legislation, Joe Manchin concluded that most would not support it and were simply cycling through disingenuous reasons to vote no. "I'm very, very disappointed, very frustrated that politics has trumped, literally and figuratively, the good of the country," he told reporters after the vote. The six Republican senators who voted to advance debate on the commission included Susan Collins, Bill Cassidy of Louisiana, Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, Bob Portman of Ohio, Mitt Romney of Utah, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska. All but Rob Portman had voted at an impeachment trial in February to find Donald Trump guilty of inciting the insurrection and rioting. A seventh Republican, Senator Patrick J. Toomey of Pennsylvania, missed the vote, one of 11 senators to do so, but said he would have voted to advance debate on the commission. Bill Cassidy of Louisiana argued his party was also making a strategic mistake in blocking the commission, giving Democrats reason to pursue partisan investigations of what happened on 6th of January with or without the Republicans. To ensure the investigations are fair, impartial, and focused on the facts, Republicans need to be involved in the investigations, Bill Cassidy said. After his own flirtation with supporting the bill, Mitch McConnell worked aggressively to quash support. To convince his colleagues that Democrats were acting in bad faith despite the bipartisan nature of the commission, Mitch McConnell circulated an interview with James Carville, the Democratic strategist, urging his party to make the Republicans own that insurrection every day. It was a marked shift for Mitch McConnell, reflecting how his political calculus has changed since 6th of January. Though he made some of his party's most stinging condemnations of Donald Trump's attempt to undermine the election outcome, the minority leader has now made a clear decision that his party's fortune and his own personal fortunes depend on putting the events of 6th of January firmly behind them in favor of attacking Joe Biden's agenda. In rejecting the commission, Republicans resisted emotional appeals from those affected by the rioting to drop their opposition. The mother and longtime girlfriend of a Capitol Police officer who died after clashing with the mob on 6th of January led an emotional last-ditch lobbying campaign on the eve of the vote, teaming with police officers who had responded to the assault. "I couldn't stay quiet anymore," said Gladys Sicknick, the mother of police officer Brian Sicknick, who died after the 6th of January riot and assault. The group also included Michael Fanone, a Washington police officer who was brutalized by rioters and pleaded with them to spare his life, and also Harry Dunn, a Capitol police officer who is black and faced a slew of racist slurs during the attack.
Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. The UK has called for a complete overhaul of the Northern Ireland Protocol, a key part of the Brexit agreement that Prime Minister Boris Johnson reached with the EU in 2019. On Wednesday, Brexit Minister David Frost issued a new command paper that would radically revamp the Northern Ireland Protocol, which he himself negotiated. Frost's new proposal was rejected by the EU, with the European Commission saying that we will not agree to a renegotiation of the protocol. The Northern Ireland Protocol is a main component of the Brexit withdrawal agreement, whose main goal is to maintain an open land border between Britain's Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland in order to facilitate the free movement of goods. The protocol, which only came into force in January, has led to additional checks and delays on goods entering Northern Ireland from Britain. Joining us now is our correspondent Jerome Hughes, who's with us from Brussels. Jerome, how far apart are the EU and the UK on the issue of Northern Ireland?
There's no doubt, Bardier, that they are very far apart, and really there's no sign right now of any hope in terms of them coming to some sort of a resolution. I mean, from the UK side, they're saying it's unacceptable that this Northern Ireland protocol is creating so much friction in terms of goods that are moving from Britain to Northern Ireland. And what the European Commission is saying is that, look, we are willing to examine any proposals and look at them in good faith, but it has to be within the parameters of the Northern Ireland Protocol. That the Northern Ireland Protocol is effectively the only show in town. It's an international agreement. Both sides knew exactly what was in it. And now you have a situation whereby the UK government is rowing backwards. And when you speak to senior officials here in Brussels, they have this feeling that, you know, Boris Johnson's arrogance is somewhat being fueled by the fact that he has such a big majority in Parliament. You remember the 2019 landslide victory that he had during the general election and actually increased the number of seats, Tory seats, by 48. And now they have a majority of 80 seats in the House of Commons. And before that, you had Theresa May's government, which was being propped up by the DUP. So Northern Ireland unionists had a big say in what went on. In fact, they were able to scupper an agreement she reached with Brussels because they felt that there was a situation where there was this status being given to Northern Ireland, and effectively it made them less British. They consider themselves completely British. They don't want anything that aligns themselves more closely with the Republic of Ireland and the EU vis-a-vis the rest of the UK. And so they had power when Theresa May was in power. But with Boris Johnson, they don't have that. So Boris Johnson is able to, he feels he's very politically strong. And on paper, there's no doubt about that he is. But unionists feel disenfranchised. And the European Union considers Boris Johnson and his government to be completely unreliable, completely untrustworthy, that anything that they actually do agree that, you know, the UK side could back down at any point. And you've never seen relations so bad between the EU and the UK. Don't forget, it's not that long ago, the UK was a member of the European Union, a strong member of the EU. Now they just look more and more like enemies. And, you know, one of the bad situations here, it could be a situation whereby you could have an all-out trade war between the EU and the UK. But perhaps the worst-case scenario, Bardia, would be if we saw a situation of violence breaking out in Northern Ireland, because the patience of unionists is running out. Okay, we don't have a hard border yet between the Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, but even so, this fact that this status has been given to Northern Ireland, which just differentiates it from the rest of the UK, unionists just are not happy about that at all.
All right, thanks a lot, Jerome Hughes, joining us from Brussels. Well, joining us, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Morsanopoulos, joining us from the British capital, London. And also writer and political analyst, John White, from Edinburgh. Well, let's start off with Mr. Saeed Morsanopoulos from the British capital, London. Mr. Abbas, welcome to Spotlight. Britain has demanded that the EU overhauls the Northern Ireland Protocol just a year after it was agreed. Why have the Tories changed their tune on the NI Protocol?
I think partly your reporter said that there is an arrogance and there's a sense that Britain can do what it likes within this government that they have in office at the moment. It's very, very unrealistic. But they are constantly pushing and hustling for breaking of more and more rules and regulations that they've agreed to. I mean, this has become a track record. You know, the latest one is obviously laughably started off with a row over sausages, but that's kind of a red herring. You know, there has been a whole situation where the proposed ban on fresh Great British sausages in Northern Ireland could very effectively be banned. But that's a bit of a red herring because there are, according to Northern Ireland businesses themselves, much bigger problems that are looming. And even though this ban is due to take effect, this protocol is due to take effect in October, it seems that these looming problems are increasing. And the central one is the amount of administration needed for actually shifting food from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. Of course, they're meant to do the checks now at the Northern Ireland border, which prevented that happening at the Northern Ireland border, which actually, of course, has disturbed the unionists as well, those people who don't want to see any shifting of the relationship of Northern Ireland with Britain. So they've started murmuring, of course, saying that anything that looks like they have to be creating any kind of nominal border between mainland Britain and Northern Ireland for them is a red line. And so, of course, there have been allegations of threats being made to people in the export sort of section there on the coastlines, but in reality, it's kind of a perfect storm that people are arguing is building up. But normally, I mean, food products entering the single market require a complicated piece of administration, and that's known as the Export Health Certificate (EHC). But supermarkets currently don't need those for most products moving from GB to Northern Ireland. That's due to change in October, which will effectively be part of a perfect storm. And that's what people are really worried about. What are the consequences of this, really, as to what will happen beyond October?
Let's cross over to John White in Edinburgh. Mr. White, the EU, they immediately rejected the call coming from Britain, saying that Britain needed to respect its international obligations and pointed out that it had been negotiated by Prime Minister Boris Johnson. This wasn't imposed on Britain. It was an agreement that was negotiated. Why doesn't London want to honor its own handiwork?
Well, a government that fails or refuses to abide by its obligations enshrined in internationally binding agreements instantly becomes a government of a pariah state, and that's what Brexit has ushered into being. Britain is now a pariah state. Boris Johnson lied in the run-up to the 2019 election when he said there will be frictionless trade between the EU and the island of Ireland, and now he is sowing dragon's teeth. He is trying to play to his newly acquired red wall working class base in the deindustrialised north and midlands of England and South Wales, and he's going to dial up the xenophobia, the anti-Europe xenophobia, the base British nationalism. Look out for the Churchillian rhetoric and the references to the Second World War. This is a government of rogues, and it's a government of rogues brought into being by a nation of sheep, in the words of Edward R. Murrow. The EU is doing nothing wrong here. It's only asking for the UK government led by Boris Johnson, to abide by its agreement. There was no coercion, there was no sleight of hand. It was agreed in the context of the Brexit negotiations in 2018-2019, and the Britain already is trying to break those agreements in order to assuage a unionist rump in the north of Ireland that has nothing to offer the people of that province other than sectarianism, other than bigotry. That is where we are now.
Senator Abbas, let's go over some comments from the British Business Secretary, Kwasi Kwarteng, said on Thursday, a deal is a deal, but it wasn't something that was going to last forever. He also claimed the agreement wasn't written in stone. Well, they don't write agreements in stone anymore. It was written into international law. Unpack these comments for us, please.
Again, it's slithery comments. They're kind of really get-out techniques, which politicians use very, very regularly when they don't want to abide by international rule of law. You see, of course, Donald Trump, Britain's partner across the West Asia, has been breaking these laws. It's become a kind of a precedent that's been set, unilaterally pulling out of trade deals, not agreeing things. I mean, it seems like Britain definitely is catching that habit from the Americans. And I think the problem with what they're doing, of course, is added to what's going on with COVID-19 and the exodus of a lot of the immigrant workforce at the ground level, what you're seeing is a dangerous accumulation of factors which could actually impact on supplies to supermarkets in Britain. I mean, if they continue as they are, what with this kind of business with Brexit and adding to the problems that they potentially got, there are already murmurings that the army may be on standby to have to deliver certain foods, because a lot of the vegetables and the market places is suffering because of potential lack of drivers even being able to take products goods. So the last thing Britain really needs is more, headaches like this. But under the protocol, it was agreed that Northern Ireland would continue to follow EU rules on product standards to prevent checks along the border. Checks would instead take place on goods entering Northern Ireland, as I said, but the bottom line is the agreement that the British government is clearly trying to renege on all of this. They want a complete new negotiation. The EU is saying we're not having any of it. What we've got in terms of the protocol, we're going to do everything within those boundaries. There is an Article 16 locked within the protocol, which does allow for some flexibility in terms of extenuating circumstances that may arise due to economics and other factors. But, and funny enough, the EU almost exercised Article 16 in terms of changing some of the agreement they had within this protocol. And they did that over COVID-19. The the passing of COVID-19 vaccines. In the end, they pulled back pretty sharpish because there was a bit of a hue and cry. So Europe didn't go for it, but Britain certainly is. They're trying to trigger this Article 16, saying, look, it's part of the protocol that we're allowed to do this. But the game behind this really is more of a we don't care about Europe. And I think that in the long run, this isolationism that Britain seems to be heading in terms of at least with Europe will only make their own trading more and more difficult, given the constant threat of COVID-19 new strains coming out all the time, shutdowns of the economy, closures of the high streets, etc.
Mr. White in Edinburgh, Boris Johnson's government, he's warned that it will suspend parts of the agreement if the EU doesn't budge. The EU has threatened trade sanctions if Johnson unilaterally breaks his promises. If this row escalates any further, are we looking at the possibility of what many are labeling right now as a mini trade war?
Yes, but this will play politically into the hands of Boris Johnson and his administration, because this will dial up the anti-Europe xenophobia. This will play into the hands of the narrative that Britain has been put upon by this monolithic, tyrannical Brussels bureaucracy, and this will play well with the Brexit heartlands that has propelled him into power in 2019 and continues to maintain his popularity regardless of all the scandals and the crises ushered into being by his failed policy on on COVID. So Boris Johnson will seek to extrapolate as much political capital from this as possible. Brexit was always an emotionally driven political project. It was never about reason, it was never about rationality, it was never about bread and butter issues. It was all about a supposed reach, emotional reach back in time to a golden age where Britain ruled the waves, Britannia ruled the waves, and the Union Jack flew wherever it damn well pleased. Boris Johnson has more political acumen than his detractors would have us believe, and he understands base nationalism is a very, very powerful, powerful political force, and he's going to play to that in regards to his opposition to EU on the Northern Ireland Protocol.
I'm going to stay with you, Mr. White. The rising cost of Brexit for Britain was divulged on Thursday as a new analysis showed quitting the EU had delivered an £18 billion blow to UK trade in goods. Now, if this impasse does continue, how will this affect the British economy?
Well, it will obviously affect it deleteriously, but this was never about economics, as I just said. This was all about emotion. It was about the legitimization of far-right tropes regarding British identity, immigration, and the representation and meaning of British history. It is the acme of British mythologies regarding British history and regarding Britain's place in the world. So it's never been about economics, it's been about base nationalism, and it's a very, very dangerous motive force indeed.
Mr. Abbas, Ireland, it isn't where the line is drawn, pun intended there, as Gibraltar remains an issue in post-Brexit talks. Gibraltar's border with Spain, like that between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland, is a divide between the EU and a non-EU Britain. What if the provisions of that temporary deal between the UK and Spain come into question?
Well, that does flare up very regularly, and I think it's being kept in check because of wheeling and dealing and behind-the-scenes negotiations. So it's still very much a vulnerable area, just as the Northern Ireland situation is. These are all flashpoints, and one does get the feeling that somebody somewhere certainly is quite happy to engineer these flashpoints, because all of this would bring back the old rule Britannia kind of mentality, and that is something which the Tories have definitely been stoking. They would be quite happy with Britain having a kind of a nationalistic, if you like, outlook and being more united. Don't forget that they're also internally battling the idea of Scottish independence, and the idea of Welsh independence has reared its head, and that the Scottish independence certainly hasn't gone away. In fact, it's gathering more pace. So Boris would need anything he can to try and sort of keep Britain together, because there's, of course, that threat of fragmentation of Britain due to Brexit, because the Scots aren't terribly happy with the way that England is certainly approaching the whole Brexit question. So yes, there are many, many issues which are really about territorial fragmentation, which Boris is risking as well. He would say that actually he's creating a rallying cry for a unified United Kingdom, and they're all for this kind of bringing back the old jingoism of empire days, almost, if they could. I mean, if it was down to Boris, he certainly would, but there's a limit to what they can do. It's manifesting on the street, of course, in Islamophobia, in a rise in racism. You saw, even with the English football players just recently, that the minute the English football players missed a bunch of penalties, and they happened to be black, there was a huge storm on social media, in which there were racists who came out very openly attacking those black players. And of course, there's been a response, and doesn't mean that everybody in Britain is racist, but this issue of xenophobia, this issue of racism, this issue of nationalism, as my colleague pointed out, is a major factor in winning political votes in the heartlands. And so perhaps that is more important to Boris than Britain's economic future. He probably won't be here when the real consequences of Brexit kick in, which will be that Britain will certainly not have as much wealth passing through it as it did, given the trade it had with the EU.
Let's get a final thought from Mr. White. Is Boris Johnson's recent Asian presence, both the diplomacy push and also the announced South China Sea military deployments, do you think they're intended to divert attention from some of these post-Brexit uncertainties?
Absolutely. This is the politics of mass distraction. This is desperation. This is an attempt by Boris Johnson to assert Britain's stature on the world stage post-Brexit, trying to hark back to the ghosts of Britain's imperial past. But the great Labour leftist Nye Bevan said it best. A reactionary is a man walking backwards with his face to the future. I can think of no better summation of Brexit in our time. Britain is a post-colonial theme park, a 19th century post-colonial theme park, and in poetic irony, rather than ushering a new golden age for British imperial prestige on a world stage, it has only ushered in the coming breakup of the UK. And when that day comes, such a cry of freedom will ring out around the world, such as never been heard before.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guest, journalist and political commentator, Saeed Mohsin Abbas, joining us from the British capital, London, and also thanks to writer and political analyst John White, speaking to us from Edinburgh. Also, thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now. Thank you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.